Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Elizabeth Goitein of the Brennan Center for Justice, who takes a critical look at President Obama's Bush-like stance on the treatment of terrorist suspects being held at the Naval Detention Center at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. Bernie Meyer, a participant in the 1969 DC-9 protest against Dow Chemical's use of Agent Orange in Vietnam, who talks about his recent visit to Vietnam, where he met many of the chemical defoliants victims. And Steve Kretzman of Oil Change International, who discusses a landmark trial coming to a New York City court, pitting the allies of executed Nigerian social justice activist Ken Sarawiwa against oil giant Royal Dutch Shell. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The Guardian newspaper reports Sri Lanka plans to keep over 250,000 displaced persons in camps for up to 2 years. Sri Lanka's government states it will maintain its control of camps for internally displaced persons in northeast Sri Lanka, the home base of the former insurgency of the Tamil Tigers, which collapsed in mid-May. The government had kept journalists and aid workers out of the conflict zone in the waning days of fighting. Sri Lankan military spokesman Lakshman Ilugule told the Guardian newspaper, "The United Nations cannot dictate terms to us. They can always make a request, but the UN has not asked us to release people." 14 humanitarian aid agencies, including Oxfam, issued a statement protesting Sri Lanka's restriction on movement inside existing refugee camps, including use of vehicles, making it impossible to provide adequate services in the camps. Save the Children says a quarter of pregnant women in the camps were malnourished. The government insists it is providing adequate services, including food, water, and security in the refugee camps. The government has detained some 9,000 guerrilla fighters and is concerned that other Tamil Tigers may be hiding in the refugee camps. House Democrats have taken the first step to pass a cap-and-trade global warming bill by moving it through the Energy and Commerce Committee on a mostly party-line vote. California Congressman Henry Waxman, chief sponsor of the bill, along with Massachusetts Congressman Ed Markey, called the vote historic, leading to an end of American dependency on imported oil. Yet, the 930-page bill was full of compromises. The bill will give away 85% of carbon pollution permits rather than auctioning them off as advocated by candidate Barack Obama last fall. The Waxman-Markey bill calls for a 17% reduction in greenhouse gases by 2020. The compromise bill also fell far short of the goals set by the International Panel on Climate Change, calling for a 20% reduction in carbon emissions from 1990 levels. The Waxman-Markey bill will only deliver a 4% reduction. A number of utility executives endorsed the Waxman-Markey bill, but Greenpeace, Friends of the Earth, and Public Citizen declined to endorse the climate bill because they viewed it as too favorable to polluting oil and coal interests. May the 17th was observed as the International Day Against Homophobia, honoring the day in 1990 when the World Health Organization took homosexuality off the list of mental disorders. Yet, before the Day Against Homophobia got underway, local police in Moscow descended upon a small gay rights rally outside the Eurovision Song Contest. According to the American Prospect magazine, the protest lasted less than 2 minutes before police moved in to arrest the activists. They were arrested for doing little more than talking with reporters. In Eastern Europe and the Muslim world, opposition to gay and lesbian rights is fueled by religious and conservative social values. Opposition to gay rights is often characterized in a manner very similar to anti-Semitism. Gays are seen as subversive with powerful international connections. Homophobia has risen as advances in gay rights have progressed in Europe and the United States. In Africa, Burundi recently passed a harsh anti-gay law, making gay sex punishable for up to 2 years in prison. In Uganda, gay sex already carries a life in prison sentence, with some Christian evangelicals pushing for harsher penalties. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Indu Anand.
Soon after taking office, President Barack Obama issued an executive order calling for the closure of the U.S. detention facility at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, within a year. But the question of how to treat and where to place the detainees held there remain unresolved. In a speech on national security issues made at the National Archive on May 21st, Mr. Obama issued a set of policy statements, often contradicting the principles he articulated during his campaign for the White House. While banning torture and abuse of terrorist suspects held by the U.S. military and CIA, the president now says he'll adopt the Bush-era policy of indefinite preventive detention of certain terrorist suspects, denying them due process in military or civilian courts. Mr. Obama also reversed his prior forceful opposition to George W. Bush's military commissions used to try terrorist suspects being held at Guantanamo. Now, the president says he wants to make several congressionally approved changes to the commissions, a position that many human rights groups reject as inadequate to address the deep flaws of the system. Meanwhile, former Vice President Cheney, Republican legislators, and right-wing talk show hosts accuse Mr. Obama of endangering national security with his plan to move many of the 240 detainees held at Guantanamo to U.S. prisons. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Elizabeth Guaitin, director of the Liberty and National Security Program at the Brennan Center for Justice at the New York University School of Law. Guaitin explains why she is troubled by many of President Obama's positions on the treatment of Guantanamo detainees.
I think that, you know, President Obama did oppose, well, when he was a senator, he opposed President Bush's military commissions. He is now saying that he has not changed his position, that really his problem was not with military commissions in general, but with President Bush's particular form of military commissions. But what's disturbing is that the form that President Obama is now proposing really looks very, very similar to what President Bush had in mind. And in particular, these commissions will still allow detainees to be tried and convicted to life sentences or even to the death penalty, based on evidence that was coerced. Now, President Obama has said that evidence obtained by cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment is off the table, and that's good. But there's a level of abuse that falls short of cruel, inhuman, and degrading that is still coercion, that essentially is an involuntary confession by the defendant that will be used, that will be at least on the table to be used in order to put people away for life or even subject them to the death penalty.
Elizabeth, what's your assessment of President Obama's striving for some new legal framework in which to hold detainees indefinitely without trial? Again, very similar to what President Bush had done before. It seems that there have been some high value, as they call them, Al-Qaeda suspects in custody who have been tortured, some of them horribly, who can't go to trial, and therefore there's a reluctance, of course, to release them. Your comment?
Well, at this point, we don't know that there is such a thing as a detainee that we currently have in custody who cannot be tried in a court of law for whatever reason. So we're all talking in hypotheticals. And I think people are a little too willing to accept this hypothetical that there's such a thing as a detainee who cannot be tried or convicted for anything. And in fact, our laws make it extremely easy to put people away for support of terrorism. They don't even have to have engaged in terrorist activity. So for example, Ali Al-Mari, who was designated an enemy combatant and held in this country, pled guilty to conspiracy to support terrorism. So that was two steps removed from actual terrorist activity, and he still faces 15 years in prison. So it's not that difficult to put people in prison for association with terrorist activity. So that's the first thing I would say. The second thing I would say is, if it really is the case that the only good evidence, or the only evidence that we have to put some somebody away was obtained by torture, then we don't have any good evidence. I mean, the idea that torture somehow produces reliable evidence that's sufficient to actually put somebody in jail or even subject them to the death penalty has, I hope, been debunked by this stage in the debate.
In principle, you are very much opposed to preventive detention, as are many other human rights groups. And what is at stake here in terms of the whole methodology of enemy combatants and holding people forever if necessary without trial or access to attorneys, which was the brand of the Bush administration? What's at stake for our country and the rule of law here?
I think what's at stake is who we are as a nation. I mean, we have never done this. We have never had a law that enables our government to put people in jail conceivably forever based on no evidence, no charges, but simply a prediction that they would be dangerous if they were released. And, you know, it is true that the law of war, in some circumstances, allows the government to hold enemy combatants during the duration of the conflict. But the war that we're fighting right now is a very different war, and somehow that notion that it's a different war is always invoked in order to take away rights from the detainees. But sometimes I think it cuts the other way. And in this situation, this is a war that we know isn't going to end within our lifetimes. There is no defining event that can end this war. And that being the case, I think it would just be a violation of everything this country stands for to say that these detainees can be locked away for the duration of the conflict, knowing that it's a life sentence, knowing that it's a life sentence that's being imposed without any charges, any evidence of a crime.
Elizabeth, as we conclude, as you said at the outset, there was a lot of hope that President Obama would make a clean break with what many feel are unconstitutional powers that were invoked by the Bush administration after the September 11th attacks. But it looks like in many of these cases, Obama has adopted them for himself, maybe with some changes. But are you optimistic this can be turned around with enough public pressure?
Sure. I think it can be. And I'm definitely encouraged and heartened by the fact that there is so much public discourse right now about these issues, even at a time when the economy is in such a predicament and there are other priorities like healthcare that are very much on people's minds. And I think it is really a testament to the American public that they understand the importance of these issues and that they're still concerned and talking about these issues. So I think that's a very hopeful sign, and I absolutely think that there's still an opportunity for this administration and this Congress to do the right thing on these issues.
That was Elizabeth Goitein, Director of the Liberty and National Security Program at the Brennan Center for Justice at the New York University School of Law. Contact the center by calling area code 212-998-6730 or visit their website at brenncenter.org. On May 18th, the International People's Tribunal of Conscience, meeting in Paris, determined that the use of dioxin by the U.S. military in Vietnam from 1961 to 1971 was a war crime and a crime against humanity. Dioxin, one of the deadliest chemicals ever produced, was the active ingredient in Agent Orange, 21 million gallons of which was used as a defoliant by American forces during the war in Southeast Asia. The tribunal found Dow Chemical, the maker of Agent Orange, and other chemical companies guilty of colluding with the U.S. government. This decision from an international group of lawyers followed the decision of the U.S. Supreme Court in March not to hear a case brought by representatives of Vietnamese civil society and by American military victims of Agent Orange. The court let stand a lower court ruling that the plaintiffs could not sue because Agent Orange was an herbicide used as a defoliant and was not a poison targeting humans. In other words, those who died or have suffered injuries as a result of their exposure were considered expendable by being labeled as collateral damage. Thousands of GIs and their offspring were affected, along with 3 to 4 million Vietnamese. Bernie Meyer, a former Catholic priest, along with 8 other activists, participated in a 1969 action that destroyed Dow Chemical Company files in Washington, D.C., as a protest against the use of Agent Orange in Vietnam. The protesters were known as the D.C. Nine. When the group began planning a 40th anniversary gathering held in mid-May, Meyer decided it was time to visit Vietnam and meet some of the victims of Agent Orange in person. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with Meyer about his visit.
There's a long list of the way Agent Orange and dioxin was the main ingredient. It's a very lethal, the most lethal chemical created by humans that was in the Agent Orange. Some children are born as blobs, literally. Some with two heads, three legs, some with no arms. Anything imaginable, it's that way. But then there are others who are born with spinal bifida. Some just have difficulty speaking. Some have cross-eyed. Any number of effects. So it gets inside the victims, and sometimes it affects their own bodies at certain times. Like many veterans were affected 10, 20 years afterwards, you know. But it affects their children, too, and grandchildren. It gets into the system and stays there.
Bernie Meyer, I attended the DC-9 reunion in mid-May, which you unfortunately couldn't attend because of a medical emergency. But you were linked in by phone, and also the other member of the DC-9 who accompanied you to Vietnam showed the PowerPoint presentation that you prepared about Friendship Village outside Hanoi. That was a project co-founded by George Mizo, a Vietnam vet who became a leading anti-war activist and whose death in 2002 was linked to complications from his own exposure to Agent Orange. Tell us about your visit.
It's a story of reconciliation between Vietnam generals and leaders and American leaders, and how they joined together to treat the victims, both the veterans as well as succeeding generations. So Friendship Village is a place to treat and educate and help many people along these lines. And there's an international group of sponsors to this, but also an international group of veterans who go there from time to time, if not live there, to care for people. It's quite a story to see it. There's an organization called VABA, Vietnam Association for the Victims of Agent Orange, and they're established in several cities. They set up an itinerary for our visit, so we went to Hanoi, Hue, Da Nang, and Ho Chi Minh City, which was Saigon during the Vietnam War time. And so we visited and were hosted by each of those local parts of VABA.
VABA was involved in the lawsuit against Dow Chemical, Monsanto, and other chemical companies for their role in producing Agent Orange. And just one day after the DC-9 reunion ended, the news came on May 18th that an International People's Tribunal meeting in Paris had taken testimony from more than two dozen individuals and determined that the use of Agent Orange by the U.S. government was a war crime and that the chemical companies were complicit in that crime. This seems so anachronistic, coming almost 40 years after Agent Orange was last used in Vietnam. Can you tell us more about this?
There's an international group of lawyers of conscience that sponsored this tribunal, and they've done it for a couple other issues, too. So my sense is that after the U.S. Supreme Court threw out the case against the chemical companies raised by VABA, that they had no choice but to take it another place, and the other place they found was, you know, this voluntary group of people. There's 4 million victims estimated now in Vietnam as a result of this. And it's also true that the U.S. government, after several years, finally started agreeing that U.S. troops were victims of Agent Orange. So reparations are being made there with U.S. victims. But the U.S. government's not doing anything like that with the victims in Vietnam. To me, I put this in the context of war-making today. The effects on people are pretty lethal before, during, and after the war, you know?
That was Bernie Meyer, a participant in the 1969 DC-9 action against Dow Chemical Company and a longtime peace activist. For more information on the Friendship Village project, visit the website vietnamfriendship.org. Thank you. During the mid-1990s, Nigerian author and activist Ken Sarawiwa led a movement to challenge oil giant Royal Dutch Shell for their environmental devastation of the land and abuse of local people as they drilled for oil in the Niger Delta region. In 1994, Mr. Sarawiwa and eight other Ogoni tribal leaders in his movement were accused by the former Nigerian military regime of murdering four Ogoni chiefs. After a special military court found the activists guilty of what human rights groups claim were trumped-up charges, the nine accused were hanged on November 10, 1995. Now, 14 years after Sarawiwa's execution, Shell Oil Company will soon face the dead activist supporters and allies in a New York City courtroom. Shell stands accused of requesting the assistance of the Nigerian military to silence Sarawiwa and his movement, which led to the 1995 executions and other crimes against humanity in the Niger Delta. The corporate world is watching this case closely, as a ruling in the 10 plaintiffs' favor could usher in a new era of corporate accountability through U.S. courts. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Steve Kretzman, executive director of Oil Change International, who is coordinating the Shell Guilty campaign to bring attention to the Sarawiwa case. Kretzman provides some background in the lawsuit and explains what's at stake for restraining criminal corporate conduct in the developing world.
In Manhattan, Royal Dutch Shell will finally go on trial for crimes against humanity surrounding its role in the execution by hanging of the author and activist Ken Sarawiwa and eight of his colleagues. And it should be noted that Shell's involvement in the Niger Delta quite credibly possibly led to thousands dead, but that's a much bigger story. This trial is for what's called the Ogoni Nine. Some listeners may remember this. Ken Sarawiwa was hanged in 1995 at the end of a trial which was broadly condemned by Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, the British government, and others as being a complete sham. Really, a lot of people who observed this trial felt that Ken and the Ogoni's only crime was the success they had in organizing a nonviolent movement to stop the pollution by Shell, in particular, of their small part of the Niger Delta, the Ogoni homeland there. And it's a very successful movement. They, at one point in early 1993, held a demonstration of 300,000, which, to give you some perspective, the entire population of Ogoni is 500,000, so that's quite an organizing job, 3/5 of the entire population, where they demanded that Shell leave their territory. And Shell indeed did leave, but then the response on the part of the Nigerian military with the help of Shell was quite brutal. Many people in the communities died. Ultimately, Ken Sarawiwa and his colleagues were framed for a murder that I believe they didn't commit.
So, Steve, what is the objective? What's the goal of this lawsuit? What are the plaintiffs, the relatives of Ken Sarawiwa and the others that were hanged by the Nigerian military, allegedly with Shell's complicity, what's the sought-after goal here?
You know, at this late date, what you can get is potentially a verdict that Shell was indeed liable and complicit in these murders, and you get some monetary compensation, which, you know, on one hand would be a great victory and would certainly be an important signal sent to multinational corporations around the world that their actions abroad will be scrutinized and held to account. On the other hand, you know, you sort of have to wonder, gosh, is money really adequate in this situation? I mean, I was asked to testify on this issue in front of Congress several weeks ago. And at the end of my testimony, Representative McGovern, who was chairing the committee that I was testifying in front of, asked me, if Shell is found guilty, will this be an adequate verdict? And my answer was, you know, if your neighbor was pouring poison toxic waste into your backyard where your kids were playing and they were getting sick, and when you started to protest, they actually, you know, came out into the backyard and started just shooting you and your kids and et cetera, et cetera. Obviously a terrible situation. And then they offered you some small percentage of the profit that they had made off of those activities as recompense. Would you think that was justice? And, you know, I think the obvious answer is no, none of us would. And so at some level, we really have to wonder, sure, it will be very important for Shell to be found guilty in this situation and for Shell to be held to account for its activities. But at some deeper level, you have to wonder, you know, is there a point at which corporations can be really held to account in a way, you know, in the same way that people would? Is there a way that we can say to corporations, you know, you've actually been complicit in murder here, and therefore we, the people who gave you your social contract to operate, are going to revoke that social contract. And, you know, it's a corporate death penalty. And it would be the breakup of the corporation. And I think that's the kind of thing that when corporations are guilty of this thing in an organized way, as we certainly seem to see with Shell in this case, I think that's the kind of thing that should be on the table.
Steve, tell our listeners a bit about the current conflicts in the Niger Delta oil fields, the activities of guerrilla groups, and raids by the Nigerian military into the towns and villages there.
You know, the conflict that's going on in the Delta today and what happened in the Niger Delta 15 years ago with the execution of Sarawiwa are actually, in my view, quite intrinsically linked. You know, really what happened 15 years ago was that you had a tremendous nonviolent social movement that was led by Ken Sarawiwa, an articulate, charismatic figure who, helped internationalize the cause. He really brought together disparate elements in Nigerian society behind him. And essentially, the lesson that was given to Niger Delta peoples who were initially very, very hopeful behind Sarawiwa was that nonviolence doesn't work. And when you go and you kill the nonviolent leaders and you kill off the nonviolent movement, the lesson that gets sent, sadly, tragically, to the next generation in the Delta is the only way to protect ourselves is with arms.
That was Steve Kretzmann, Executive Director of Oil Change International and coordinator of the Shell Guilty campaign. Learn more about the Wiwa versus Shell case by visiting the group's website at shellguilty.com. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Indu Anand, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.